That's not what I meant. The Sociolinguistics of Everyday Conversation, Lecture 9. Gender. Women and Men Talking.
As we've seen in the previous lectures, conversational style can differ by a whole range of influences: ethnic background, regional background, age, economic class, sexual orientation, profession, and gender, and many other cultural influences too. This lecture will focus on the issue of gender, ways of speaking that tend to be associated with women and with men. This is also the topic of a separate audio college lecture series, Women, Men, and Language. So if what you hear in this lecture interests you, you can get a fuller account in that series. If you get the feeling when you talk to someone of the other sex that you're talking to somebody from another world, the reason is you are. In a sense, boys and girls grow up in different worlds. For one thing, they're treated differently, but also they tend to play with other children of the same sex, and they learn their ways of talking from their peer groups at play. I want to tell you a little bit about an experiment that I took part in that first got me thinking about this metaphor that conversations between women and men are like a kind of cross-cultural communication. I was invited by a psychologist, Bruce Dorval, to take part in a research project that he had devised, and he got support for this project from the Social Science Research Council. Dr. Dorval was interested in how children of various ages talk to their best friends, so he invited numbers of children to bring their best friends into his lab, in his studio, and he had them just talk to each other, and he videotaped their conversations. Because children's best friends tend to be of the same sex, what he ended up with was dyads, pairs of boys and girls at different ages, 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 15-year-olds, college students. He then got further funding from the Social Science Research Council to get scholars in a whole range of disciplines to come together and look at these videotapes and comment on how these children and young adults use language in talking to their best friends. So I was the linguist on the project. What I had intended to focus on was repetition. That's what I was studying at the time, and I've written quite a lot on the topic of repetition. That is how, when we talk to each other, we pick up the words of the other person and weave those words into our own discourse, and what the functions of those repetitions would be. But when I looked at the videotapes that Dr. Dorval had made, I could not get over a pattern I was seeing by which little girls, older girls, little boys, older boys, and then adults establish physical orientation when they talk to their best friends. So what I saw was that at every age, the girls and the women tended to face each other directly and look at each other continually while they talk to each other, whereas the boys tended to sit at angles or even parallel and look around the room. Now, I noticed at the time that I was finding this pattern, I commented on it to a colleague of mine who was a family therapist, and she said, you know, I see the same thing when couples come to me in therapy. The men don't look at their wives. The men don't look at me. The men are always disengaged. And this really set my danger signals beeping because I thought, well, if this is how boys and men of various ages orient themselves when they talk to each other, is it fair to say they're disengaged? In other words, it was a classic conversational style difference. She was assuming the men must mean what she would mean if she talked in that way in that context. And for many of the other women, probably that conclusion would be accurate. But for many of the men that came to see her, it probably would not be accurate. So I realized I was dealing with a conversational style difference between women and men with regard to how they manage the physical orientation when they talk to each other. The second thing that got me thinking along this line was an article written by Daniel Maltz and Ruth Borker called A Cross-Cultural Approach to Male-Female Conversation. They took the theoretical approach that was developed by John Gumpers, the anthropological linguist whose work I cited earlier, and who was also one of my professors at the University of California, Berkeley, and they applied it to conversations between women and men. What they pointed out was that boys and girls learn their uses of language as children at play. Now, Maltz and Borker didn't do the original research on kids, nor did I, but they brought together research done by a whole range of scholars, including Marjorie Harness Goodwin and many others, and showed the patterns that the researchers found in how boys and girls play. And this is what, taken all together, these research studies show. Typically, a little girl has a best friend. She spends a lot of time sitting and talking. And it's the talk that makes the girls best friends. A way that I sometimes put it is talk is the glue that holds a relationship together. So little girls tell each other secrets. And the person you tell your secrets to is your best friend. Furthermore, girls tend to play one-on-one or in small groups, tend to play inside. And when they do play in groups, there's a real value placed on keeping the appearance of equality. So girls don't like it if another girl acts like she's better. And so they might say about each other, boy, she really thinks she's something. If a girl tells another girl what to do, she's bossy. They don't want to play with her. So girls spend a lot of effort trying to keep an appearance of equality. Of course, we all know if you've been a girl or known a girl, that not all girls are equal. There are popular girls and less popular girls. But the girls who are more popular don't lord it over the unpopular girls in an obvious way. Of course, they have ways of showing this. And there's been a lot of research on this recently on mean girls and the ways that girls are tough on each other. But many of the conversational rituals that are common among girls keep the power differences in the background rather than the foreground. For boys' groups, these status differences are in the foreground. So typically, boys play in larger groups, and it's the activity that's central. Your best friend is the one you do everything with, not the one you tell everything to. And the boys' groups are more obviously hierarchical, so the high-status boys will give orders, and they'll push the low-status boys around. And so talking in a way that gets as high status as possible actually gives you more freedom and independence. If you end up in the lower status position, then you get pushed around. And this actually explained to me emphasis that I really didn't understand, which boys and men will often place on don't let anybody tell you what to do. Because if you get told what to do, it means your status is low, and you're really going to find your freedom limited at every turn. Another way boys use language in their play is to take center stage, try to hold that center stage by perhaps boasting, telling stories about what you've done, boasting about your prowess, and competitive talk about who's best at what. And so we heard earlier, these are big shoes in the conversation from the preschool that I read you from the study by Corsaro and Rizzo in an earlier lecture. You heard little boys saying, these are big shoes, and this is a gun, and my gun's bigger than yours. And that's really quite typical of the way little boys talk when they play. The result is that boys and girls as children learn very different assumptions and habits about using language in relationships. So if we go back to that grid that I described in my lecture on power and solidarity, every conversation that we have, we're trying to find the right place on this grid that is relative hierarchy, how is one person one up and one person one down, as well as relative connection, how close or distant are we. Many of the conversational rituals that are typical of the girls at play focuses on that closeness-distance dimension. And many of the rituals that we observe in the boys' play focus on that hierarchy dimension. Going back to a conversation that was taped among little preschool kids at play, and by the way, this is in a training video that I made, which is called Talking 9 to 5. You see three little boys playing, and they're talking about how high they can hit a ball. And one says, mine's up to here. And the other one says, mine's up to the sky. The next one, mine's up to heaven. And the fourth one, mine's all the way up to God. So they're topping each other, and that's their way of playing. And then in the same training video, Talking 9 to 5, we had the cameras caught some little girls playing, and it's totally different. They're sitting at a little table, they're drawing with their magic markers, and one girl says, did you know my babysitter called Amber has already contacts? In other words, she wears contact lenses. And the second girl says, my mom has already contacts and my dad does too. And that's that kind of repetition that I'm interested in. The girls put a lot of emphasis on not trying to top each other. And so she uses the same format and almost repeats her words, has already contacts. And then the first girl is really, really excited and she says the same. So she's as excited about being the same as the boys are about topping each other. So we learn these different ways of focusing on power and solidarity in conversation. When boys and girls grow up to be men and women, we find that we're, again, using conversational rituals in these systematically different ways, and we often don't realize that they are conversational rituals. We think we're just talking. But because our rituals are different, we tend to take literally the other person's use of language and often be confused by the other person's use of language as well as the other person's reaction to us. So let me now discuss some of the specific differences, different patterns that we observe in women's and men's ways of using language and how they can lead to mutual frustration. I'm going to start with a truism that you hear all the time, but believe it or not, actually came from my book, You Just Didn't Understand. And that is the question, why don't men like to stop and ask for directions? I was completely surprised, by the way, and it's a kind of like to say this sometimes at the start. I was completely surprised at how much attention that one example in the book You Just Didn't Understand got. And the reason I was surprised is because my own husband and my father do stop and ask for directions. And I'm the one who says, no, no, dear, I can find it on the map. And that's not typical. It's more typical that men are more comfortable reading maps and that women are more likely to stop and ask for directions. But I like to say that because I'm going to be saying in this lecture women, men, women's styles, men's styles, but it's always important to keep in mind that nothing is true of all women and men because we have all these cultural influences, regional influences on our styles, as well as just individual personality that I talked about in earlier lectures. Okay. Why don't men like to stop and ask for directions? Well, if you look at this different focus on connection and hierarchy, from the point of view of connection, okay, you stop, you make a fleeting connection to a stranger, you get where you're going, you haven't lost anything. From the point of view of hierarchy and status, though, if you say to somebody, I'm lost and I need your help, you're putting yourself in a one-down position to a stranger. Well, for a lot of men, that's uncomfortable. So it makes sense to drive around for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes or however long it takes to get where you're going on your own. By the way, a lot of men have commented to me that's not it at all. If I ask somebody, they probably don't know either, and they're going to tell me the wrong thing. That's why I won't stop. Well, that's really true, but I'm interested by the fact that I very rarely hear from women, if somebody doesn't know, they're going to tell me the wrong thing, whereas I hear that quite often from men. And it's true, I think, that people sometimes send you on a wild goose chase. But the assumption that people who don't know don't want to say they don't know is also a reflection of this awareness of the status or hierarchy dimension, being aware that the way you talk is going to be the basis for your being evaluated. And if you say you don't know, you put yourself in a one-down position. Here's another conversation that was reported to me but seems to take place quite often around the country and around the world. A man and a woman are riding in a car, and the woman turns to the man and says, are you thirsty, dear? Would you like to stop for a drink? And he's not, so he says, no. And then it turns out that she's annoyed because she would have liked to stop. And his feeling is, why do you play games with me? Why didn't you just tell me you wanted to stop for a drink? And her feeling is, and this is, I guess, my take on it. When she asked him, would you like to stop for a drink? She didn't expect a yes, no answer. She expected something like, I don't know, how do you feel about it? And then she could say, I don't know, how do you feel about it? And then they could talk about how they each feel about stopping for a drink, and any decision would be fine. So he might say, well, I'm not thirsty, but if you are, we could stop. Or I'm not thirsty, but if you want to stop and have a talk, we could do that. Or he might say, I'm kind of tired. Would you mind if we didn't? Or we could stop, but only a brief time. In other words, there are many, many things he could have said that would have been fine. What's significant here is the framing and the meta message. So from her point of view, when she says to him, "Would you like to stop for a drink?" she's sending a meta message that she's interested in what he wants. She's not making a single-handed demand. She wants to start a negotiation where she finds out how he feels. And in some sense, she really doesn't know whether or not she wants to stop until she knows how he feels about it. So the meta message is, "I care about what you think." When he answers, "No," she hears a meta message, "I don't care what you think." And later they might have an argument where he says, "Why didn't you tell me?" And she says, "Well, we always do what you want anyway. Why should I bother?" Because from her point of view, his no was non-negotiable. I would argue in many cases for many men or for women, if they operate this way, when he says no, it isn't non-negotiable. It's just his way of saying, "Well, this is how I feel, but it's the beginning of a negotiation. If you don't feel the same way, let me know and we'll talk about it." So if we look at the framing, it's two different ways of starting a negotiation. If we look at the meta messages, she was sending a meta message that she was interested in what he thought. She was receiving a meta message, I don't think he was sending it, that he wasn't interested in her. So these are conversational rituals that seem quite common in confusions that occur between women and men. Here's another one. It's the end of the day. Maybe one of them has been home and the other comes home. Maybe they've both been out at work and they both come home. Whatever the situation is, he asks her, if he has learned to ask, "How was your day?" And maybe he doesn't even ask. Maybe she just volunteers. And she says what she did and what she said and who she ran into and what they said and what she heard and what she read and how that made her feel and how that made her, what that made her think. And she tells all the ins and outs of her day. And then she turns to him and she says, "And how was your day?" And he says, "Same old rat race." "Well, really? Didn't anything happen?" "No, just a day like any other." And then maybe they go out to dinner with two other couples, and suddenly he is regaling the gathered party with some funny story about what happened during the day. And she feels, "What am I, chopped liver? I'm your best friend. Remember the little girls. Talk is the glue that holds a relationship together. Your best friend is the one you tell everything to. So if I'm your best friend, you should tell me first. I shouldn't hear things as a member of an audience with a group of strangers." It comes down, in a sense, to different ideas about the role of talk in a relationship and different understandings of what's anything to tell. So from her point of view, telling all the details of your day is anything to tell, not because you think all these little details of the day are important in themselves, but because sharing your day, telling everything that happened, provides talk, and talk is the glue that holds the relationship together. From his point of view, it isn't anything to tell. I sometimes quote the opening dialogue in the movie Divorce American Style. That was Debbie Reynolds and Dick Van Dyke years back. And the movie opens with an argument in which he's saying, "What do you mean we don't communicate? I tell you everything that's on my mind." And she says, "You do not." And I think right there, it's this difference in what is anything to tell. Another funny story that captures that, when my book, You Just Didn't Understand, was published, and a lot of this material comes from that book, it's about women's and men's conversational styles. I was on my way to a talk show. This was in New York City, and I was being driven in a taxi to Rockefeller Center to appear on a talk show. And I was telling the driver what my book was about, and he looked up. He was talking to me in the back seat, and he said, "My wife and I have good communication." And I was very pleased to hear that. And then he went on and he said, "But sometimes when she talks to me, I just don't answer." And I thought, how strange. How could it be good communication if he doesn't answer? So I asked him to explain, and he went on to say that they had good communication because if, for example, they had a decision to make, they would sit down, they would discuss the pros and cons and make a decision. If they wanted to go on vacation, and she liked one kind of vacation and he liked another kind of vacation, they would come to an agreement. Maybe one trip would be the kind he liked, the other would be the kind she liked, or maybe they would find some place where they could both do what they liked. So that's why he felt they had good communication. Well, then I asked, why would you sometimes not answer when she talked to you? And he said, you know, he's looking at me through the rearview mirror. He said, sometimes what she says just doesn't make any sense. And I asked for an example of that. And he said, well, like the other day, I'm watching the game on television. And of course, you can see the problem right there. He wants to watch television and she wants to talk. And there's a difference right there. She needs to talk to feel connected. For him, they're doing something together, watching television. That's fine. They're connected. So he went on and he said, so I'm watching the ball game and she says to me, what should my brother do? And he said, her brother's 35. Why should I give him advice? And I think this example captures the next element of conversational style that distinguishes or often distinguishes women and men, and that is a conversational ritual that linguist Gail Jefferson has called troubles talk. That is, for many women, talk is the glue that holds a relationship together, and a kind of talk that is really preferred is troubles talk. It's ritual complaining. You feel close to each other because you can tell your troubles to each other. Now, my guess about his wife, the taxi driver's wife, who said, what should my brother do? She wants to get the conversation going because she wants to feel close, and so you want to talk. And maybe she didn't have any problems of her own to talk about, so she's going to borrow her brother's troubles. Now, from her point of view, talking about troubles is interesting in itself. It's a kind of talk that she values, and a term that I use for a kind of talk that you frequently find among women is rapport talk. And that's rapport, R-A-P-P-O-R-T. It creates rapport to talk. And you want to talk in order to create and have a feeling of rapport. So troubles talk is a prime kind of rapport talk. Because many men don't do that kind of rapport talk, they don't do troubles talk to create rapport, they take it literally, and they think she must be telling about her trouble because she wants me to fix it. She wants a solution. And so he offers a solution. He tells her how to fix the problem. And she can be very put off by that. You know, don't tell me what to do. And his feeling is, well, why do you want to talk about it if you don't want to do anything about it? Another aspect of it is that again, you can look at it from the perspective of solidarity or connection or from the perspective of hierarchy. So if she keeps bringing up troubles talk and he keeps giving her solutions, she's being fixed in a way in that one down position. She's the one who always has troubles and he's the one who always has solutions. And you can really see that in the taxi driver's comment, why should I tell her brother what to do? He's 35. So his point of view is, I'm being asked to solve my brother-in-law's problems, and that would be treating him like a kid who can't solve his own problems. So I think that that was a very revealing remark that he made. For many women, they feel put down when men keep giving them solutions, but they really didn't want the solution. They just wanted to talk about it. A woman told me about a frustration along these lines. She was telling her husband about something that happened at work, complaining about it, and her husband said, well, if you don't like your job, you can quit. And I would guess that he felt he was being very generous here and very supportive, right? Telling her that she doesn't need to do the job, she doesn't need to work if she doesn't like it. Well, she was really taken aback. Why do you say that? She said, I like my job. So he was taking the ritual complaining to be real, the troubles talk to be a much more significant discussion of a problem than she took it to be. And again, it's because if a man doesn't do troubles talk as a ritual, then perhaps when he really does bring up a problem to talk about, it's going to be something of much more significance to him. A lot of men say to me, by the way, why should I talk about my work troubles at home? I was upset about it at work. If I talk about it at home, I'm just going to be upset all over again. So I'd rather come home and forget about that problem and not think about it. In this sense, I think many women and many men have a very different definition about the comfort of home. So for many women, when you're out in the world, you have to be very careful of what you say. You know, you might say something and hurt somebody's feelings. You might spark a conflict. You might say the wrong thing. But now you're home with somebody you're close to, you're free to talk. And his feeling may actually be quite the opposite. Now that I'm home, you know, I've been out there all day having to talk to make sure I get the respect I deserve, to prove myself, to make sure I know what I should know. And now I am home with somebody I feel close to. I am free not to talk. Because the role of talk in the close relationship is different. She may feel that talk is necessary to feel close, rapport talk, and he feels just being together provides that closeness. An example I often give about this is my own parents, and I should say that they are about to celebrate their 71st anniversary, so they have been talking to each other for a very long time. But a few years ago, my mother told me her frustration. She noticed that my father was holding his arm in a kind of a funny way, and she asked him what the problem was. He admitted that it hurt, and she asked how long it had been hurting, and he said, oh, just a couple weeks. Again, she had a kind of, what am I, chopped liver response. I'm your wife. You should tell me if your arm hurts. You shouldn't keep it a secret. Well, I asked my father why he would not have told my mother that his arm hurt. And his response was very interesting to me. One comment he made at first didn't make any sense to me. He said, I guess I always was taught to be protective of women. Protective, I thought, what does that have to do with it, right? I'm thinking about the closeness distance dimension. If you tell about your problems, you're close. If you don't, you're distant. What does protectiveness have to do with it? And he said, well, you know, if I tell her about it, she might worry about it. And if I don't tell her, I'm protecting her so she doesn't have to worry. You know, maybe the pain will go away and she would have worried for nothing. So that's the hierarchy, the protectiveness. He made another comment, too, that was enlightening as well as amusing. He said, and you know, if I tell her my arm is hurting, pretty soon I'm going to be coming up in the elevator and some woman that I've never seen before in my life is going to say to me, Eli, how's your arm? Because for my mother, troubles talk is a way of creating connection to her friends as well as to her husband. And so when her friends ask what's happening, she's going to fill them in, oh, Eli's arm has been hurting him. And my father commented, not only would he find it intrusive for this woman to comment on his arm, but he also feels that it puts him in an unappealing light. You know, as a man, he doesn't want women to see him as weak, as the focus of sympathy. Again, think of the example I gave earlier of Robert Bly commenting that a man who's broken his leg doesn't want women all the time saying, oh, you poor thing, how did it happen? They would rather it just be ignored. And so that's how my father felt about his arm. What I said earlier about the different interpretations that women and men often have about the comfort of home explains another paradox as well. We have a stereotype that women talk more than men, and yet researchers continually do studies and find that men talk more than women. The following experience that I had kind of captures that. I was talking to a group of women and men in the living room of one of the couples, and I was talking about women's and men's conversational styles, and I made the kind of comments that I just made about women using talk as a way of creating closeness. And there was a couple sitting on the couch, and he had been the biggest talker the entire evening, and she had not opened her mouth the whole evening. And when I made this comment again, he volunteered to speak, and he said, pointed to the woman next to him, and he said, that's absolutely right. She's the talker in our family. And everybody laughed. So he was a little bit chagrined, didn't want to be laughed at. I said, you know, why do you say that? And he said, but it's true. At the end of the day, we come home. If it was up to me, I just wouldn't say anything, but she talks all evening. And if she didn't, we would spend the evening in silence. Well, who's the big talker, she or he? In the public situation where I was giving a talk to a group, she didn't say anything, he was the talker. In the private situation where it's just the two of them, he doesn't say anything, she's the talker. And I sometimes describe this as public and private speaking. So the public situation, when you think about it, is much more akin to the way little boys use language at play. In other words, he has to take center stage and show that he knows what he's talking about. And I think there's also a very generous aspect to it. I was the visitor. He's doing me a favor, making contributions so that I wouldn't be faced with a silent audience, which would be uncomfortable for me. I think it is a very generous thing to do, giving your talk. So that public situation is one where he had more experience talking and felt the need to talk. For her, at home with the person you're closest to is where you feel both the need to talk, but also you're more comfortable talking. If you go back to the little girl talking to her best friend, you can see she has a lot more experience as well as feeling more expectation for talk in that situation. In all these situations, understanding is key. Let's think of the example that I gave of a woman who's telling about problems and a man who wants to fix the problem. Now, I've heard many people suggest, okay, what she should say to him is, well, I don't want a solution, just listen. Well, that sounds good, but it's going to drive him crazy to listen if it doesn't make any sense to him, if he doesn't know why he should listen. And in fact, many of the examples that I give of styles that just tend to distinguish women and men, remember I said earlier that between my husband and me, he's the one who often wants to stop and ask directions, and I might be the one who wants to look at the map. Well, when it comes to troubles talk, we do fit this pattern quite typically. I like to talk about troubles, and he likes to give me the solution. Well, one time he commented, and I was talking about something, and he said, one time I was talking about some problem or other, and my husband interrupted, and he said, you know, I know you don't want the solution, but it's too frustrating for me to sit here and hear you go on and on when I know the solution. So how about I tell you the solution, you listen, and then if you want to keep talking about it, you can. Well, to me, that makes just as much sense as my saying to him, just listen. In other words, both of us could adjust by listening to something the other person is saying that may not be exactly what we want to hear. So he might listen to me telling problems, but I might listen to him telling the solution. What's really important is for women and men to both understand why the other one reacts differently to the same conversational ritual, so that he won't feel that his partner, his sister, his mother has a deep-seated problem, that she talks about problems and doesn't want to solve them, and she won't feel that her brother, her husband, her boyfriend, her father is so ornery that he thinks so little of her that he keeps giving solutions when she just wants him to listen. So to her, it's a failure of connection as well as a violation on the hierarchy dimension. In other words, he's putting her down if he gives solutions. It's an interesting thing for women to understand, too. Often, men will react to each other's problems by kind of dismissing them. Ah, that's really not a problem. And women will often react to that by feeling he's dismissing me because he's dismissing my problem. Whereas many men will actually appreciate that because delving into the problem, the way women often do when they're talk with each other, for many men might feel it's making them feel worse. Boy, you've really got a problem. So dismissing it might be a sign of respect, kind of pulling him back up rather than wallowing in that problem. This is actually a very natural segue into the next topic, which is apologies. And apologies are a conversational device that, again, often differs by gender, but just as often differs by culture. And when attitudes and expectations regarding apologies differ, it leads to significant frustration, both in public as well as private situations.
This ends Lecture 9.